This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Joan Ledeau. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. We're talking about how to avoid serious respiratory illnesses this winter, and we're happy to have Dr. Jonathan Tempe with us for the rest of the show. He's the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And one of his specialties is respiratory viruses. And of course, we want to hear from you. Are you dealing with a respiratory illness? How can the doctor help? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Tempe, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Jill, and good afternoon, and wishing a happy Lunar New Year to all of your listeners.
Yes, that's kind of nice to get to celebrate twice. And ironically, Larry's not here today because he has a respiratory illness. And I'm sure that you've been seeing a lot of that this year, haven't you?
We have indeed. And I would argue that we're kind of near the peak of what we're going to be seeing for the year. And the reference to the Lunar New Year, oftentimes our peak of influenza and RSV and other viruses coincide with that later New Year's that we celebrate.
Okay, well, it's good to know. I guess I hadn't thought about that. Do you know why?
Respiratory viruses really like people congregated indoors. And so every year in Wisconsin, one of the things we see is as soon as our school year starts in early September, almost without fail, a week later, we see an increase and a dramatic increase in respiratory visits in our primary care and urgent cares. And that kind of continues on. But the other factor is, as we get colder, it creates situations in which the viruses really transmit much better. So if we look over a long, long period in Wisconsin, we can see that when our average temperature drops below freezing, we see a significant increase in influenza. And conversely, when we drop out of freezing, for example, like today, we see influenza tend to go away. But so the viruses like congregation, they like cold, dry air for transmission.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Health keeps track of the viruses based on emergency department visits. And their website says that flu activity is very high and RSV activity is high. Now, how common is it to see these levels as high as they are right now?
We are in a pretty typical year right now, meaning that we're seeing high levels. We're not seeing extraordinarily high levels. And every year is a little bit different based on the strain of influenza we see circulating. It depends on many other factors. So for example, early after the peak of our pandemic, we had 2 years in which people really hadn't had much exposure to respiratory viruses outside of COVID. And then all of a sudden things hit really hard. If you remember the twin or the triple demic back a couple of years ago, and we saw influenza hit extremely early. And right now we're seeing things kind of revert back to where things were prior to that pandemic.
Is there any research going on as to why that happened with the tridemic?
Well, every year, a good number of us come down with various virus illnesses. And in the wake, if we survive, and most of us do, we generate some immunity toward what's been going on. But that immunity tends to be short-lived. And if we go 2 or 3 years without having anything, then all of a sudden, we tend to get sicker when we do. The best example I can give you is for new parents who have a child going to daycare for the first time. And they may have gone for several years without any serious infections. And then all of a sudden with their child in daycare being exposed, they get sick for the first couple of years, almost reliably all winter long.
Yes, I've seen that with a lot of my friends who have contact with a lot of the youngsters. They do tend to spread it, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we've been talking about this term respiratory virus. What's actually are the symptoms of a respiratory virus?
almost all of the viruses do very similar things. So they give us runny noses, nasal congestion, sometimes a sore throat. And then we also see that they can affect our breathing. And so we generate coughs, some people with wheezing. And if we have underlying breathing problems such as asthma or COPD, the term we use for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, we can find those conditions being worsened and people having more difficulty breathing. Along with those respiratory symptoms, we also will see fevers sometimes, aches, tiredness, lack of appetite, and so on. And after working with these viruses for years and years and years, I can tell you that it's really difficult to know what somebody has just by looking at the symptoms alone, because there's a great deal of overlap. And so it really helps us to know both the symptoms and what is in circulation at the time. And that can help us be better clinicians.
So when should someone seek your advice, or a health official's advice on what they have? When is time to go to check it out?
Well, I always say that when we have really significant symptoms, so if we're having difficulty breathing, if we're having a high fever that just is not relenting with acetaminophen or with ibuprofen, if for any reason we're feeling uncomfortable with how we feel, how a family member feels, how a child feels, those are all good reasons to come in and be seen. Occasionally we'll see people with sore throats bad enough where they're not swallowing well. Sometimes we'll see people with significant dizziness and so on. And those are all things that might prompt us to come on in. But, you know, if I step back and put on my hat as a family physician, I will say anything that worries you, give us a call and we can help you determine whether or not you need to be seen.
Oh, that's great advice. And I think we probably know this answer to this question, but maybe we don't. How are respiratory viruses spread?
They're spread from one of us to the next. And most of them are spread by what we term respiratory droplets. And these are small liquid particles that come out of our nose and mouth when we cough or sneeze. In some instances, viruses can be transmitted through aerosols, which are even smaller particles. And there are studies out there that have shown that simply talking or singing when you have COVID can transmit to other people. If I go back in my memory to our most transmittable virus, measles, that one is notorious for aerosol spread and can hang in the air for a long time. So a person can be in an airspace such as a waiting room in a clinic and be gone, and half an hour later, somebody can come in and contract measles. So this is why we take things like measles very, very seriously.
And of course, we got used to, most of us wearing masks during COVID. Is that a good idea even now when you're not feeling well?
Absolutely. A mask will, first and foremost, catch anything that you're unable to block with your hand or your elbow. So when you cough and sneeze, that mask can capture many of those respiratory droplets. Maybe not all of them, but it really reduces the likelihood of transmitting to the next person. Conversely, if you're somebody who is really interested in avoiding getting infected, and in particular, people with underlying medical conditions or people with immunocompromise, that wearing a mask can provide a lot of additional benefit. Also, staying away from crowded areas, staying away from people who are coughing and sneezing, good idea as well.
Okay, sounds good. Vernon Eau Claire County called. He's wondering about influenza A, how long before it's not transmittable, and after you've contracted it, and is influenza A a virus or a bacteria?
Well, influenza A is a virus, and it comes in two different flavors, basically. There's influenza A H3 and H1. And this describes proteins on the surface of that virus. And there's also an influenza B. And if we're going to be complete, we also have to worry about influenza A H5. And that's the one that we're seeing in dairy cows and in poultry. But these are all viruses. And the influenza A that normally affects people and influenza B, both are easily transmitted over about the first 5 days of symptoms. And so from the time you're exposed until you develop symptoms is usually between 24 hours and 3 days. And you're have the worst of your symptoms at about day number two of symptoms, when you have high fever, you can have cough, you can have aches and so on. And then the symptoms gradually go away over the next 2 or 3 days. So a 5 day course is pretty typical. And after 5 days, we have a hard time isolating virus from people's noses and throats. So I usually tell patients to stay away from especially vulnerable people for those first 5 days.
Okay. And we've got a question from John in Plover. Go ahead, John.
Yes. I'm 61 years old, and several years ago, I was diagnosed with latent TB. And I'm concerned, is it, could it turn into active TB? How concerned should I be? And by the way, I did take the 6 month regimen of antibiotics, the recommended antibiotics. I don't recall the name when that happened.
Okay, thank you, John.
That's fantastic. You took the medications and were adherent for that 6 month course. Well, latent TB indicates that you were exposed to tuberculosis at one point in your life. And what we know is over the lifespan of people who have latent TB, about 1 in 10 will go on to develop active tuberculosis. By going on that medication for the 6 months, that reduces the likelihood by about 90 to 95%. So tuberculosis doesn't tend to be a seasonal infection. It tends to be more one that we get when we're exposed to other individuals with tuberculosis. And if you're paying attention to the news, there's a big outbreak in Kansas right now. Fortunately, in Wisconsin, we see sporadic cases, but we haven't seen any big clusters at all. But again, I think the take home here is latent TB indicates you've been exposed, but you haven't developed the active TB. And the best thing we can do for that is put you on that prophylactic medication that will lower the risk for the rest of your life.
Okay, thanks for that question, John. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He is an Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And one of his specialties is respiratory viruses. Do you have questions? Please give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Just a reminder, our first book club selection is about a month away, and we're reading The Snowbirds by Christina Clancy. And the book follows a married couple who've hit a rough patch, and then the husband goes missing. I hope you all read along for what's sure to be a thrilling mystery and an honest look at marriage. Again, that's coming up at the end of February, so you still have plenty of time to get it. Right now, we are talking about respiratory viruses and your health. And so please give us a call if you have a question, 800-642-1234. Dr. Tempty, we had an email from Dennis. He says as his allergies increases his nasal discharge. This is probably to flush particles and possibly microbes. Though excessive discharges is inconvenient, does it benefit the body, or does the sputum accommodate more microbes than it expels?
Well, I think there's a purpose for us to produce a lot of mucus, and in general, it helps to clear things out. On the other hand, one of the side effects we have from this extra mucus production is plugging up various cavities in our bodies, such as our sinus cavities. And if they're not draining well, we have this wonderful liquid with a lot of protein in it that is nice and warm at body temperature and can sometimes make a good environment for bacteria to live in. And so we see at some level, people with a respiratory virus infection and that nasal discharge then developing what we call an acute sinusitis, which is typically a bacterial infection. And so by and large, if we try and reduce the amount of discharge, we typically don't slow down the process of clearing the infection. We're largely relying on our immune system to do that. So I think whereas we don't have great evidence that any of those over-the-counter medications will cure a disease, sometimes they do help us to feel better. I hope that answers your question, Dennis.
I believe it did. Thank you. So what advice, are some of the immunizations that are available that might help us out with this? And is it too late to get them?
So the second part of your question I'll answer first. And the answer is no, it's not too late. And early on, I said, I thought we were pretty close to being at peak of influenza right now. That means we still have at least half of the cases yet to come. And so if we can prevent those, all the better. Now, if I take a step back, we have a number of vaccines out there that are aimed at respiratory infections. And there are three that are aimed at viruses. So influenza, the COVID-19 vaccine, and the RSV or respiratory syncytial virus. We also have a couple other vaccines aimed at other bacteria that cause respiratory infections. So one is the Tdap vaccine, which stands for tetanus, diphtheria, and the respiratory component pertussis or whooping cough. And then the last one is a pneumococcal vaccine. These are all aimed at people of different ages, sometimes with underlying medical conditions. But let me just divert right now to the influenza vaccine and the COVID-19. Both of these are recommended for everybody 6 months age and older, and are recommended if you've had them before on a once-a-year basis. If you're over 65, you're eligible for a second COVID vaccine 6 months after the first. And if you're immunocompromised, you're eligible for even more additional doses just to provide that protection. But these are really wonderful preventive tools. And I'll say they're vastly underused in Wisconsin right now. Latest data I have is only about 1 in 3 of us have received the flu vaccine. Of the people eligible for the RSV vaccine, only 1 in 5. And of the COVID vaccine, only 1 in 6 of us have received that vaccine this year. So we have a long way to go to try and become better protected.
Okay. I've got 2 of those. I was not offered RSV. Who's supposed to be getting those? That?
Well, Jill, you're far too young for that. Now, we routinely recommend RSV vaccines for individuals age 75 and older, and for people who are age 60 to 74 who have some significant underlying medical conditions. And the last caveat I will throw out is a very small segment of our population who are younger are eligible for RSV, and these are women who are pregnant. But we give that vaccine over a pretty limited time during pregnancy, from 32 through 36 weeks of gestation. And after tomorrow, we're going to say we don't need to do that until next year. It's a time-limited vaccine. We typically do it between September and the end of January. But that's a vaccine that will protect the mother, but more importantly, it'll protect the developing fetus, because when that infant is born, they're pre-equipped with immunity for RSV, and RSV is terrible for infants. Every year, anywhere from 2 to 3% of children or infants are hospitalized for RSV, and we can prevent that through vaccine or through a new injection for infants.
And what are the symptoms of RSV? How are they different than the regular flu or COVID?
Yeah, well, RSV is really interesting because we can get it over and over throughout our life. We don't tend to develop much immunity toward it. And more than anything, for older people, and so school-aged children and adults, it's that really nasally cold that we get in the wintertime. With a great deal, I'm thinking back to Dennis, who had called in, but it's the one that produces a great deal of nasal mucus. We're constantly blowing. When I'm seeing young children in the clinic, I usually refer to the characteristic sign as the green 11, because they have two streaks coming out of their nose.
You, let me say you.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. But RSV really is terrible for very small people because it produces a great deal of mucus, and that mucus coats their airways. And because of that, they have real difficulty breathing. And so just a quick anecdote, the day that I made a visit for the residency program that I eventually joined here in Madison, went out for lunch with one of the residents who was currently in. He had been up all night, and he'd put 17 infants into the hospital overnight with RSV. And so that's the type of thing that we can see. And we don't have any treatments for this. After you have it, we don't have any good evidence-based interventions other than supportive care. So now we have a vaccine we can give to mothers to protect the infant after the infant's born. And we also have not a vaccine, but a monoclonal antibody. So a special chemical or a special antibody that we can inject. It's very safe, and it'll protect that infant for the next 6 months of life. So this will give them the protection during the entire RSV season.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I'm assuming pediatricians offer that readily?
Yeah, absolutely. We would love it if more of our birthing hospitals, you know, places where people actually give birth, would provide that to the newborns, especially, you know, day one or two. But as it turns out, most of the monoclonal antibody is being provided in outpatient clinics, either pediatrician or family practice offices.
Okay, well, we have a question about RSV with Ruth from Chippewa Falls. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hello. I want to know if I have to get that RSV every year.
That's a great question, Ruth. And right now, this vaccine is licensed for a one-time administration. And we know it was licensed about a year and a half ago. So what we're learning is coming from not only our experience with people who have received this vaccine, but from the clinical trials done by the pharmaceutical companies prior to that vaccine being out to the public. And what we know right now is it's providing protection for at least 3 years, and it may provide protection up to 5 years, but we don't have any evidence or any recommendation right now for revaccination. So that's something we're waiting to hear about, and we'll try and let people know ASAP once we do. I kind of anticipate we'll probably be on a 5-year schedule for older adults with that vaccine when everything is said and done.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ruth. Appreciate that call. Deb emailed us, and she says, we've heard for years about viruses and colds spreading in cold, dry conditions, especially if people are congregating. And aside from congregating, don't southern hemisphere areas with warm, moist temperatures still have cold and flu seasons?
That is a wonderful question.
We have great listeners. They're so smart.
from an epidemiological standpoint. And in fact, it's really interesting that here in Wisconsin, we're northern temperate climate. We have four distinct seasons or even more, depending on who you talk to. And likewise, if we look at countries like Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Chile, Argentina, they have very similar influenza seasons and respiratory virus seasons. However, they're offset by 6 months. They correspond to the Southern Hemisphere winter. Now, what gets really interesting is if when we get into those countries that form the middle section of our globe, you know, the subtropical and tropical areas, and we see respiratory virus season more affiliated with monsoon, when there's a lot of rain and people are congregating indoors, but you don't see quite the same really distinct peaks that we see up here in the higher latitudes. So it's a great question, and it really speaks to how important congregation is for respiratory virus spread.
So, and let's get into prevention a little bit here. Other than, you know, try to stay out of crowds this time of year, what else are some of the other things that we should be doing?
Well, I think good hand washing is really important. I can't tell you the number of times I've been at an airport and watching a child walking alongside the human conveyor belt and putting their hand up on the black railing. And they've just been rubbing the nose, and you can watch that streak come out. And then you watch the next person come along, run their hand over that. And if, you know, the child has something contagious, watching a person rub their nose or their eye can allow that transmission. So good hand washing is really important. And I'll just put a plug in for one of our other viruses out there, the stomach flu or norovirus that's been in the news a lot. And noroviruses are really spread oftentimes by hand, and hand washing is really important. With things like norovirus, soap and water work. Hand gel, hand sanitizer doesn't work very well. The hand sanitizer does work pretty well for COVID, for influenza, and RSV, but you have to just kind of keep that in mind. But good hand washing, watching out for those crowds, and then, you know, as we've already talked about, being vaccinated, really important keys to keeping yourself healthy.
Now, when we say good hand washing, could you describe what that is? I think we've heard a lot about it when COVID was so rampant and we were so good at it, but I think we maybe forgotten. So could you go over that?
Well, and I'm guilty of this too, because oftentimes you find yourself hands under the water for 2 seconds, shake them off, dry them off. For respiratory virus protection, and especially things like the norovirus, which is more of a stomach or an intestinal infection, hand washing with soap and water and for 20 to 30 seconds is useful. We often tell people to sing the happy birthday song or Old MacDonald, depending on your predilection, but that can just help you pace that a little bit longer.
And if you're in a public restroom and sing it out loud, just be realize that people are going to stare at you, right?
Exactly.
We were earlier talking to someone about air purifying and as related to allergens. Is that something that will also help with viruses that are in the air?
It's a good question. And I would say the evidence is sketchy. Okay. We know that there have been some large studies looking at schools. And what we find is not a great deal of difference between schools with big, heavy-duty HVAC systems and HEPA filters and schools without. On a more local basis, however, we do find that air purification can really reduce the droplets that are spread in the air column and theoretically should have some benefit there. So I wish I could tell you that there's really good evidence. On the other hand, at my clinic and many other clinics, we do have an isolation room with negative air movement. And so those are rooms that if we have a patient with tuberculosis or if we had a patient with suspected measles, they would go in this negative airflow room. And all that means is the air does not come out of the door. The air gets sucked under the door, or when I open the door, it gets pulled in and out through the roof. And that can be very, very beneficial. I'll just give you another little tidbit here that some of my colleagues that we've worked closely with in our research do a lot of work with air sampling for surveillance. And we've done a lot of work within schools and in conjunction with their work. And what we can show is when I see children who have influenza or COVID in the same school, they're able to detect the genetic product of that virus by simply sucking air through a filter. And it doesn't mean that there's infectious viruses out there, but we're pulling enough air to detect the virus from the people around. So the take-home message is viruses can be, first of all, they're incredibly small. And when we cough and sneeze, we're not putting out tens or hundreds, we're putting out millions and tens of millions of virus. And happening to walk through a cloud that's just been coughed or sneezed out is a really good way to contract that pathogen.
Yes. Well, what about humidifiers? Do they help at all in the home?
Well, I think they do. And I'm not sure if they help clear the air, but having your tissue in your nose and the back of your throat being less dry, less cracked and so on, probably provides a little bit of protection from invading pathogens. So I think one of the things that really happens in Wisconsin, and we all know this happened during the last week when we had those really cold temperatures, our skin dries out, we get very itchy, our mucous membranes dry out. And what we can do is form gaps in the surface and have less of that protective mucus that we talked about, and it can be a ready entry for those viruses.
So get those humidifiers going and keep the filters clean, right?
Exactly.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempe. He is an Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. What questions do you have for him? Have you been suffering? Do you need some help? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I hope you can join us again tomorrow on Garden Talk. We'll cover the plants that earned the Green Thumb Award this year, and you'll also hear more about straw bale gardening and, of course, find out everything you've wanted to know about ferns. That starts at 11, or if you're an early riser, you can catch it again on Saturday morning at 5 a.m. Right now, we're talking about respiratory viruses. And Dr. Tempe, let's say that someone in your family starts showing symptoms of respiratory viruses. Generally, what can we do to try to avoid catching it? I mean, we're probably going to, but what can we do?
Well, a couple thoughts out there. Number one is we do have treatments for influenza and for COVID-19. There are antivirals that can be used for the appropriate people, but with a caveat, they have to be started really early. For influenza, in the first 48 hours after the first symptom. With COVID, about 5 days after that first symptom. But we also know that early treatment with an antiviral can sometimes reduce the likelihood of transmission. Our team did a study in long-term care centers and nursing homes a few years back, and we showed that with early detection and early use of antivirals for prophylaxis, we prevented a significant number of hospitalizations and emergency room visits. So taking a step back, I would say that having suspicion, you know, if somebody suddenly changes, thinking about testing, and we now have over-the-counter tests for both influenza and for COVID-19. We have better tests available in urgent cares and doctors' offices and so on. But understanding what you have can be helpful. With any respiratory virus, and I don't care which one it is, that removing a person away from vulnerable people, newborns and so on, can really reduce the likelihood of transmission. Using good hand washing, as we talked about, using a mask when we can't be isolated from each other can be beneficial. And then just kind of remembering some basics about time. So the longer after that first symptom, the less likely you are to transmit. And again, with influenza, about 5 days. With COVID, about 7 days. RSV, about 8 days after that first symptom, you're far less likely to transmit to somebody. So kind of keeping, if you just want to make it real simple, saying 5 to 7 days after onset, your likelihood goes down.
Okay.
But all those other good things in between.
All right. Jeff in Eau Claire, you have a question. Go right ahead.
Yes. My wife, about a year and a half ago, received the RSV vaccination. And then maybe 2 weeks later, someone after began losing vision, we ended up seeing a lot of different medical folks. And it turned out her immune system attacked both the optic nerve and then the nerves of her legs. And ultimately, it was diagnosed Guillain-Barré, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So in subsequent medical treatment, it's been said that the RSV vaccination in a small percentage of folks has motivated the Guillain-Barré. I think it surfaced in clinical trials and then since then a little bit. And so just wondering if you know anything about it. I will add that my wife had the latent TB, so that had she gotten RSV, it would have been very not a good situation. So she doesn't regret having the vaccination, but it's been a year of prednisone. It's been quite a journey to try it. So anyway, the knowledge between RSV vaccination and immune response, possibly Guillain-Barré. Thanks.
Yes, Jeff, that is a wonderful point to make. And I'm hoping that your wife is recovering from the Guillain-Barré syndrome, because that can be pretty, pretty awful. Well, I have to confess, I was pulled onto the CDC's adult RSV vaccine work group as a safety consultant. This is something I've done for a long time. And in the early clinical trials from the manufacturers, there was a concern about Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an acquired paralysis. It, as you mentioned, is activating your immune system, and the immune system can then attack parts of your spinal cord and produce some paralysis going on. And so that's a really significant. And this is something that from day one, we have been following very, very carefully. There have been reports put out about the cautions out there. And the FDA has recently put a warning on in terms of Guillain-Barré. The good news is this is a very rare event, but it does happen. So in the spirit of transparency, FDA, CDC, and others that are putting the vaccine out there will put that out and give that warning to doctors. Where this is important for patients is that if you have ever had Guillain-Barré syndrome in the past, you probably should avoid the RSV vaccine. But I think this is my chance to put a plug in that any adverse event is taken very, very seriously by the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, the work groups that help out with that, the CDC, FDA, and by clinicians like myself and my fellow family physicians and pediatricians and internal medicine doctors that vaccinate. We're really concerned about that. What's really important, Jeff, is that when these things happen, we also go out of our way to make sure we report them to the reporting system. There's a vaccine adverse event reporting system called VAERS, V-A-E-R-S. And if you just type that into Google, it can come up. But it allows anybody from patients and regular people to pharmacists and doctors and nurse practitioners to put reports in. And these tend to be followed up then by the vaccine safety groups.
Great. Thank you for that question, Jeff, and best of luck to you. Elaine in Janesville, it's your turn. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm calling in regards to this, whatever it is that's going on. I've had it for going on 6 weeks. It comes and goes. I got nasal congestion, headaches, body aches, lack of wanting to eat anything, cough, chills, you name it, I get it. I was doing normal stuff that I normally do when I get anything going on, and it seemed to improve after about 10 days. But it got better for 3 or 4 days, and then I turned around and got right back again where I started from. This time I went to the doctors, they done tests, they said they couldn't find nothing to explain it.
Yeah, well, Elaine, you're describing something we see not infrequently. My first thought is that most respiratory viral illnesses are self-limited. And over a six-week period, it's possible to have two or three different infections coming on. Occasionally, when we're testing our research patients, what we'll find is sometimes they have up to three different viruses that we detect at the same time. It's probably only one that's causing their syndrome, but they're carrying along the remnants of a previous infection. The other thing that could be happening is one of our current viruses, called human metapneumovirus, is the one that tends to produce really, really long syndromes lasting 4 and 5 weeks. And so it's possible that you could have this case up and down. The third thing I think about is something that we call double sickening, is when people come down with an infection, they feel bad, then they start feeling better, and then they get sick again. And those can be suggestive of a sinus infection, sometimes a pneumonia that follow on the tail end of a respiratory infection. So I think all those are out there. It sounds like your doctors are doing a good job of checking things over, making sure you don't have a pneumonia and so on. And I think that the bottom line is we just kind of have to ride that out and get through that. The last thing I'll mention, though, is with things like COVID-19, about 1 in 10 people will develop the long COVID syndrome. And that can be really devastating for some people. It doesn't sound like you have any of the symptoms of that, but we do know that vaccination will prevent long COVID. And even we now know that people who get reinfected multiple times with COVID tend to have a higher risk for long COVID, and vaccination can help prevent that.
Okay, good luck, Elaine. I hope that things work out for you. Dr. Tempty, Jeff in Eau Claire wanted to follow up. He was the one whose wife had the reaction to mention that her case is extremely rare, 8 out of 1 million people. So thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, and Jeff, thanks for that comment, because in fact, that's what the level is that we are tracking. It's about 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 200,000 vaccinees. The other thing I'll just mention is that in general, in the vaccine world, that when we see a real significant or worrisome outcome, the tolerance for that typically is less than 1 in 1 million. So the vaccines you see disappear are vaccines that have the significant adverse events that are rare but are significant. And we just have very, very low tolerance for that within the vaccine world.
Okay, thanks again for calling back, Jeff. Wayne from San Francisco Bay Area emailed us. Would you please comment on the effectiveness of zinc lozenges to reduce the symptoms and disease course of respiratory infections?
Yeah, interesting question, and it comes with a caveat. There's not a great deal of good evidence out there from randomized controlled trials to show that zinc lozenges do much. There is some evidence out there that people who, there was a time that they had swabs that people would stick in their noses. And unfortunately, there are a number of people who lost their sense of smell from that. So it can be an adverse event. I don't think you'll get that from the lozenges at all. But again, there's a whole history of various products out there, from supplements, vitamin C, echinacea, and so on. And they have either no or just marginal effect. So at the end of the day, kind of like I mentioned with over-the-counter treatments for cold and flu, if they make you feel better, that can be reasonable. If they're not making you feel better at all, they're just helping to drain your wallet. So let the buyer beware.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Wayne. Speaking of, okay, so I'm sure there's plenty of people out there listening right now that are suffering from one of these viruses that we've been talked about. What would you suggest they do to make themselves feel more comfortable and maybe quicker?
Well, I think this goes without saying for all of us. The getting good sleep, getting good nutrition, and even, you know, maintaining some level of exercise, even when you're feeling a little bit ill, can be helpful. When the sun is shining, you know, getting outside as able. And then some of the over-the-counter products can help you feel a little bit better. And again, I think we've talked about things that might help dry out the mucous membranes a little bit. So about the only decongestant we can get anymore is pseudoephedrine, which is now kind of behind the pharmacy desk. For some people who have allergic components, antihistamines can be beneficial. And we have both the antihistamines that are sedating. So maybe if you want to sleep, that can help you. Or non-sedating if you have to be awake and going through work. And I think the other thing is just really good hydration, making sure you're keeping up with the fluids, because anytime you're either febrile, you're breathing more heavily, you can lose water that you're not aware of. So hydration can help you, and that will help kind of move that mucus out as well. So,
okay. Marty in Lake Geneva has a question. Go ahead, Marty.
Thanks for taking my call. Dogs get cancer, humans get cancer. Dogs get diarrhea, humans get diarrhea. A dog we have has kennel cough. Can that be passed to us? And if so, are there all mostly similarities between the two that can transfer to each other? I'll listen to your answer off air. Thank you.
Well, the good news is most viruses are pretty selective to their hosts. So kennel cough is not something that is easily transmittable to humans. You don't have to worry about that. There are some exceptions out there. And early on, I mentioned influenza H5. That's the avian influenza that's affecting our poultry flocks. It has gotten in dairy cattle. It has jumped from dairy cattle through raw milk into cats. And so occasionally you'll see these transfers from species to species, and they can be devastating. So, for example, cats do incredibly poorly, and they die very, very quickly from this virus. So kennel cough is not something we worry about, but it's my plea right now for people out there, because we're having a lot of H5N1, that influenza, in birds. Stay away from dead birds out there, because we do know of cases where it has jumped from a bird to a human.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Tempe. We really appreciate all your expertise today.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure. And again, our wishes to Larry to feel better.
I'll pass those on. Thank you. And thank you for joining us today. This and all our shows, of course, are a team effort. Thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patinod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and host Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us.